AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll quite likely go friggin' nuts, man. And we have a very special guest today, and I've been trying to get him up for quite some time, and it's very rare that I'll actually go through the effort to try and get somebody on more than once or twice or what have you. But this guy's worth it. His name's Adam Kokesh, and you can check his website out, Adam versus the Man, and it's VS the Man, not actually spelled out. So, Adam, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you so much. I've certainly lived up to my reputation to be a pain in the butt to get a hold of.
Yeah. Which means that you've probably got a very, very busy schedule, because a heck of a lot of people like what you do and want to do something with you.
I guess you can put it that way. it's overwhelming, and it's a beautiful life. I'm quite blessed to be where I am today, and so grateful that so many people have taken an interest in what I have to say, and I'm grateful for the opportunity now to at least share a bit of my premature wisdom and perspective with your audience.
Yeah. And have you seen the movie X-Men Origins Wolverine?
I have not, actually. It's not often you can get me to sit still for 2 hours, man. I don't catch a lot of movies. I used to love movies, but since I got turned on to activism and politics in the way that I am now, man, I really don't make it out too much.
Well, rumor has it you're rather tenacious, like Wolverine, and I was just wanting to know what your origins are and how you kind of got started into all of this, who you are, well, what you do, etc.
I was into comic books as a kid, and I hate to admit it, because it almost makes it embarrassing that I haven't seen the Wolverine Origins movie yet. But Wolverine was my favorite character for just that, and I don't know if tenaciousness is something I could say that I have any particular claim to, but I did learn not to pull punches in the Marine Corps, at least, and that's my start of my adult life, if you will, after going to high school at three different boarding schools. But I only got kicked out of one, and I ended up in the Marine Corps in the reserves, went to boot camp. Summer of 2000, after I graduated from high school, went to college, volunteered to go to Iraq with the civil affairs team, came home, got in trouble for bringing a pistol back, so when I went to try to go back to Iraq the second time, I ended up getting in trouble instead, and was just disgruntled enough when I got out to really start questioning things, and that led me to really question the rest of my experience in the military as well, including my deployment to Fallujah in 2004. So when I got out in November 30, 2006, and you never forget that day, I decided I was going to move to D.C. and pursue a master's in political management at George Washington University, but ended up running away with the circus instead, also known as the American Anti-War Movement, and was very active with Iraq Veterans Against the War, and then kind of realized after watching Barack Obama get elected and being so disappointed in that, knowing that he was running on to see how much his platform changed from early primary, where in the early primary it was you know, when I'm elected president, drawing down troops in Iraq, ending the war will be the first thing I do. You can take that to the bank. I think those are pretty much his exact words. And then to see at the end of the campaign how much his position had shifted, and then to see the fine print on his platform about Afghanistan, you know, was really disappointing. Now, I never supported Obama. I was never that gullible to buy the choke. But I think a lot of people saw that and were disappointed. And what it led me to conclude was that it wasn't about issue advocacy, because, you know, the public perception on the war had changed. But that doesn't really do anything if we have to have these wars every so many years now in a state of perpetual war here in the United States. And, you know, while you've changed public opinion and they draw down from one country as slowly as possible, they've got another war going. And if you look at it with the pattern of the American empire, it's just like we're leaving, you know, Germany, Japan, you know, everywhere we go, we get to leave a residual force for as long as the government can make excuses for it. And so we end up with troops deployed all over the world. And I thought, this is really futile, you know. And I went so far as getting IVAW for Iraq Veterans Against the War tattooed on my other forearm to mirror where it said USMC on the left. And I don't regret that, because they were sort of equally seminal experiences and kind of parallel to each other in my life. But I realized that issue advocacy wasn't it. You know, convincing people that one war was bad, first of all, didn't bring about real change in policy. You know, we won the war for public opinion, and we lost the policy fight in terms of how many troops were going to be in Iraq. And that disconnect from the will of the people at that time, as I would have said it, was really alarming to me and led me to want to run for office. And I ran for Congress in 2010. I was endorsed by Ron Paul in my home state of New Mexico. And I lost, but that turned into a radio show because I was one of those candidates that couldn't shut up when the race was over. And then that turned into a TV show right before the radio show was going to be canceled. I got promoted by an outside network, Russia Today, RT America. They gave me my own show, full editorial control, 30 minutes, five nights a week, and I had a blast with that. And I knew it was only a matter of time, considering I'm an anarcho-capitalist working for a government-funded network, that even though they had the distance of an ocean and half the world, they were going to, someone in the Russian government at some point was going to be like, wait a second. This guy, we wanted you to get a Ron Paul supporter. This isn't what we meant. We wanted you to get someone who was, you know, anti-war and credible and challenging the status quo and, you know, making the government racket of the federal government laid bare. But we didn't want someone who was going to actually challenge the concept of government itself. And so I only lasted 4 months there. And I can only speculate as to the true reasoning of the Russian government, you know, for why I was canceled when I was canceled. But it was a great deal. I definitely enjoyed it a lot. I learned a lot. And more importantly, well, unlike Glenn Beck, who's a fake libertarian, I'm a real libertarian. And also, unlike Glenn Beck, I didn't jump off the top rung of the TV ladder. I jumped off the very, very, very bottom rung of the legitimate TV ladder and decided that I would go independent and that, and, you know, the future was going to be on the internet one way or another. And if I had gotten the same contract, I would probably turn it down. I mean, I was making decent money, but not, you know, people assume, oh, you're on TV. You must, no, not for your first gig, that's for sure. But I was making decent money. I really enjoyed it. And I still thought I would turn it down if I got the offer today in order to be independent as I am now. So that's really an incredible, it's really an incredible position to be in, and I'm so grateful for everybody that supported me since I started speaking out along this journey, first in Iraq Veterans Against the War, but everybody who donated to my congressional campaign back in 2009, 2010, everybody who's been listening to my radio show since then, and then to help promote the TV show by sharing the videos online, and now, you know, I'm completely dependent on the kindness of strangers donating to support my show, subscribing online, because they want to keep it going. So as long as I can serve my audience and provide something of value to them, yeah, I'm able to keep my show ad-free, and I'm really grateful for that opportunity. And now I can say I make YouTube videos for a living. Oh, and I also do, and I just started a month ago, an hour-a-day podcast, which has been a blast. So
how can people subscribe to you or donate to you, Adam?
AdamVersusTheMan.com/invest. And you can get hats, hoodies, and T-shirts that say "Adam versus the Man" on them when you do that. And we're gonna be launching a regular store as well soon. But you know, in the age of the internet, and as I'm sure you know, and new media competition, if you're gonna do something that's, you know, based on commercials and selling the attention of your audience, eventually someone's gonna undercut you and, you know, do it just for the T-shirt sales. And so that's where I'm at right now, and I'm really grateful that people are making that possible by donating, by buying shit for me. But really, it's just amazing.
I think the listeners are a very undervalued part of the radio and the viewership and what have you, and a lot of hosts and people they kind of view the listeners as sort of like this dumb group of swine or whatever that they have to sort of talk down to. When you're being directly supported by those listeners, on the other hand, you recognize something that all those perceptions of all those big guys and whatever talking behind the scenes. Oh, I can't believe my listeners are so dumb. They actually watch me when I'm doing the O'Reilly Show. You know,
yeah, it's a different dynamic. But I have to say, the one thing I've been doing really well lately is pissing them off, because I've been talking about religion and politics and being, you know, obesity and fitness and how that relates to the message of liberty and my philosophy. And wow, I actually went through this period where my audience, I've been on a steady growth curve in terms of YouTube subscribers and podcast listeners and fans on Facebook. But I noticed it leveled off for a while there, and I had a minor exodus of some of my more sensitive audience members when I started talking about atheism, started talking about how obesity is something that is a real problem in terms of actual choices that people make, and how it really is contrary to the message of liberty, and it is a bad way to live, if nothing else, to choose to eat yourself into obesity. And I was calling people out for this, and it started with, I don't know if you caught the story from London, where the NHS had this experiment. They were testing a drug they were giving a diabetes drug to obese mothers, even if they didn't have diabetes, to make sure that the child was not born with diabetes. And I was just like, you gotta fucking kidding me. There is a proven method to having a healthy baby, and it includes simply the natural, time-tested methodology of not being a big fat ass. And instead, you're going to encourage mothers to be irresponsible and risk chemically poisoning their children with medication that has
Oh, Adam, you're breaking up there a bit, man. Yeah, you're still breaking up a bit. We can't quite hear you, Adam. Can you say something again? Hello? And we appear to have lost him. Well, we'll be able to reconnect him after the break, I hope. Oh, wait, now I hear you. Adam, are you there? Yeah, we're having some... we got you, Adam. There, you're back.
All right. Well, that was, at least we were able to get back quick. Sorry about that. I don't know what that is. It's definitely on my end with the reception here. I apologize. But anyway,
and I'm looking, your Skype as well.
Thematic rant on obesity that pissed off so many in my audience.
Yeah. Well, we had an incident in New Zealand a couple of weeks ago, Adam, where the local supermarket was selling 4 2.25-litre bottles of Coke, a little more than half gallon, and four of them for $10. And a girl was drinking four of those bottles of Coke every day.
I saw that, and Coke tried to say, well, you can poison yourself by drinking too much water too, right?
Yeah. I mean, is water a level 6 biotoxin when it comes off the ships in syrup form?
Yeah, well, it's just sad to see that one of the products of the affluence that we all enjoy as a species today, the potential for material wealth and security, just that what's available to us today, part of the reaction, and I don't know if this was predictable or not, but But part of the reaction has been a desire to instead indulge in the luxury of avoiding responsibility. And that's so sad because that is such a disempowering way to live. But what's really tragic about it is that when people seek to avoid responsibility, they turn to this institution of force and violence in society, the government. And that's where it's manifest as. And of course, the things that that story that you mentioned, the woman who got a heart, who died from drinking nothing but Coke, it's kind of a combination of both of those factors. It is a destructive sort of feedback loop or spiral, if you will, when people want to avoid responsibility, and so then they trust government to make sure that their food is safe. Instead of simply saying, no, let's have the market do it, let's be conscious consumers, which is essential anyways. Okay? Having the government or an agency of government like the FDA in the United States tell you that your food is safe does not mean you don't have to be a conscious consumer to not wind up unhealthy. But then, not only do we get that, we get a government that ends up subsidizing corn, and then you get corn syrup, and then you get these kinds of processed foods that are essentially poison. And people just, this is it. By not taking responsibility for your life, you face the consequences. And part of what we're saying as libertarians is don't force your irresponsibility on others. Don't use the violence of government to make up for that or to force your will on others, because it's always a mechanism of exploitation. But we're also saying, I think the philosophy of liberty also tells us to live responsibly, to be independent, and to be more free in effect in our lives and enjoy our freedom that much more by doing so. And I think that's really important, too. So I started chastising my audience. I started chastising
Adam,
people.
Adam, we're going to have to stop you there. We're coming to break now. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Adam Kokesh, adamversustheman.com.
Nestled deep in the south of France, near Toulouse. My very special guest today is Adam Kokesh from AdamVersusTheMan.com.
Welcome back, man. Adam, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. Hey, I was thinking about something you said earlier, how Obama said, we'll get the troops out of Iraq. You can take it to the bank. Obama must have meant a fractional reserve bank, meaning that the lie later becomes about 9 times as big as it really is.
Yeah. Or he was talking about a Swiss bank that was just going to rip you off, like the UBS sponsoring his campaign. Well, maybe Goldman Sachs. Maybe it was an I bank. You can change that to somebody who's full of crap.
Oh, yeah. Now, you ever get up sometimes and you're not sure what you're going to talk about on the show today? And the obvious question is, what do you want to discuss? And the answer, I think, should be most of the time, I don't know. What are we not allowed to talk about? That's what needs to be said.
Yep. Exactly. That's the guideline. The guideline I've set for myself in posting videos or really posting anything is that I have to cringe a little bit every time that I do. Otherwise, it's not daring enough. If I'm not a little bit afraid of what the reaction might be, then it's not worth saying.
Well, you do have to do one thing every day that scares you. Otherwise, basically, you become living in your cowardice rather than dominating it. And I think once your cowardice starts to dominate you, scumbaggery starts to dominate your country, because nobody's everybody's too afraid. They're like afraid of conflict. They're avoiding all this stuff. I don't want to go out there. I went to a protest the other day, Adam, and I was like saying that my Prime Minister John Key is a scumbag through a megaphone, right? Lady comes up to me and says, we shouldn't be doing that. It's mean, you know, you shouldn't be putting all that negativity out. And we just need you to be quiet. And I was going, you came here to a protest to be quiet, did you? People have gotten that avoidance of conflict down so much that even in situations where it's warranted and expected, they try to avoid it still.
Another side effect of the affluence, I would say. Nobody wants to rock the boat when you've got... the level of... I mean, we have to stop and step back and appreciate this. This is something I like to point out in regards to the unemployment that we're experiencing in America. Although the unemployment is at record highs, unlike the last time it was like this, you know, when they called it the Great Depression, we don't have people starving. You know, our ability to maintain quality of life with less people working is increasing, and it's still largely the fault of government policies that, you know, that we are in the state we're in, where it's so hard to get a job, where people who want to work are unable to get work. But if you look at it, you take a step back and you look at the bigger historical trend from when we were in a state of nature where, you know, the average person had to work 16 hours a day hunting and gathering just to survive. Now, just the average human being can work from when they're 22 to when they're 65 for 8 hours a day, just 5 days a week. And for that sliver of productive time in their life, they're able to support a family for their entire lives. And that's pretty exciting. But you think about where this is going. Pretty soon, you're going to be able to work for 1 year and save enough money to support a family for an entire lifetime. And what, you know, what that means for human productivity, for innovation, for exploration, where the entire, I mean, we're at the point where, of so many exponential growth curves just turning to where, as human beings, they're imperceptibly different only from being vertical lines of ascent in terms of human capacity for innovation and technology and intelligence and productivity. And it's just so sad to see. And I feel like this is what we are doing as a movement, as the freedom movement, to see working on this issue that at the same time, our ability to apply that to morality, to philosophy, to social organization is in the dark ages. You know, we're taking steps backwards, but if you look at it, if you see that broader perspective and you have to at some point embrace a certain faith in humanity, if you want to be in this business at all, you know, you see that, and it's so frustrating to see that we are being held back by our fears and our insecurities and all of these things and these base impulses that, you know, lead us to institutionalize our worst desires to control and dominate others by force in government and avoid responsibility in government. And it's like we have to get this one fixed before we hit all these vertical lines, because otherwise it could get really nasty. You know, but I don't think that's the case. I'm not a pessimist in the long term. I'm very optimistic, because I think that technology is empowering, and empowerment leads to liberty. I mean, how are you going to convince people that a welfare state is necessary when what it takes to provide what we assume is a basic, you know, essential quality of life for the average person right now is something that can be done so easily in the future that, you know, charity makes government ridiculously obsolete, because the free market, or what we have in the free market, will continue these advances, and eventually government, regardless of, you know, what we decide to do with it, will become a vestigial limb, a vestigial organ of society that will just sort of wither away, if not get cut out as the cancer that it is.
Yeah, we are infected with a really, really bad cancer, and it's an irresponsibility cancer, I find. Being irresponsible does eat you away and eventually kill you, much like cancer does. You know, I think it was Ayn Rand who said you can ignore reality, but you can't ignore the consequences of ignoring reality. Mm-hmm. And people have this misconception that with great power comes great responsibility. That's not entirely true. There's plenty of people in this world who are incredibly powerful who have absolutely no responsibility whatsoever. And a lot of people who have no power whatsoever who are very, very responsible. So I'm acting under the assumption that what happens is your responsibility gives you power, but not power over other people. It gives you power over yourself. And that's generally what you really need to be capable of doing, because it's once other people have power over you that you're in a position to lose all your liberties, you know? And when you talk about
satisfaction in
I think Falcon on Chris Greenwave's show said a very interesting thing about Yellowstone Park. We've got little signs that says don't feed the bears, because then the bears and the other wildlife won't be able to actually take care of themselves anymore, will they? Because they've got somebody else providing for them. And the same thing is true of the welfare system. An argument the other day, a friend was telling me that his dad was getting like 50% tax or anything, a relatively wealthy guy. And I said, well, imagine if he was getting paying a heck of a lot more tax, how many more people he could employ and how much fewer people would wind up being on the unemployment benefit in the first place.
Yep.
We all get frustrated by the we. We get frustrated by other people not doing what we already know how to do. We get frustrated by the we. We don't get frustrated by the I, because I can change what I'm thinking about. I can change what I'm doing, but I can't change entirely or force other people to do what I want them to do. That's the source of the frustration, I think.
Well, it's also the source of great liberation to see it that way. I mean, in the true sense of being free to choose to exercise dominion over your life, to recognize that when you embrace this philosophy, when you really understand what you just said, and you're able to take charge of your life, you're able to take responsibility for your own self and your own state of mind. And this is the greatest thing. This is, you know, an old lesson from Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. If you want to be happy, just change your mind. And having that freedom is the most empowering thing that a human being can have.
Yep. With responsibility, well, rather with great responsibility comes great power. For example, the owner of a company, my girlfriend, for instance, she's working at a garden maintenance. And her boss, when he actually owns the company, sold it now, and he's just working for a bigger company now. He used to be able to say, okay, guys, it's time to go home now. They go home an hour early or half an hour early or whenever they really feel like it, if it's necessary or they want to. That's power. But he had to be in that position of responsibility in order to have that power. And now that he's no longer in that position of power with owning the company or anything, nobody's going home early anymore. And it's the thing, we abdicate our power over to determine our own daily lives by giving that power to other people in exchange for money.
Yep.
That's what happens. We're selling our power. Every day when I was going to work, I'm just recognizing it now, I was essentially renting my personal power to somebody else. Did they appreciate it? Did they give me enough back? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
This is the society that we live in now. It's a power vacuum where everybody has to work. They don't have a choice about it whatsoever. Even you and I, Adam, we have to work in some way, shape, or form in order to make ends meet and be able to eat. And there is no choice. But I don't want a society where nobody has to work at all. Because everybody would be lazy and have no responsibility, and we'd be back in the situation that we are now. I'm wondering what the balance is, though. I mean, how much work are you supposed to do versus the rewards you get out of it for it to seem fair?
Well, I don't think those are the right standards to impose, because it's not that you want people to be working, but that you want people to be free. And you don't want to define what work is for someone else. And that's where the, you know, then you kill entrepreneurship. I know that's not what you're talking about, but you know, and what I'm saying is that in the new economy that we're facing, you know, already today there are a lot more artists than there were 2 million years ago when we first evolved into human beings. You know what I'm saying? in the future, there are going to be a lot more artists. There are going to be a lot more people being creative in ways to make each other's life better and serve each other in different ways. And some of them aren't going to have to work. Some of them aren't, you know, we might come to the point where everybody inherits this. And this is important to recognize, too. And this is why it's all the more important that at this point we be free to live in this prosperity and to exercise the will as exhibited by the market, not by government, in determining an allocation of resources when we get to this point. But we are coming to the point where, you know, you're going to be able, you know, how much work is it going to take for you to, you know, just be able to put a roof over your head and food on the table? It's going to be insignificant. And already it's getting, you know, it's tough to evaluate against the government effect on the market today and how people are struggling to actually get by and meet those basic needs. But if you look at our overall productive capacity with technology, it's only going up. The only reason we are being held back is because people are being prevented from getting jobs because the government makes it so expensive through the system of taxation and regulation. And they make and innovation is stifled in terms of business innovation and service delivery innovation because it's so difficult to start a business. You have to fill out so much paperwork. You have to have you have to get loans from banks and all, you know, not necessarily, but all of those things that it takes to start a business. There's so many more institutionalized barriers to entry than you would have in a market now. So that's, you know, it's crazy to see that we're like frozen, you know, in some ways in terms of, you know, social economic development, frozen in time because of government intervention.
Yeah, and it seems whenever you look at anything with a purely logical mind at government policy, the logical conclusion becomes these people are trying to destroy the country. You know, you have a look at New Zealand's Prime Minister now. Here's their plan for economic recovery, and you'll love this, Adam. Cut jobs, increase taxes, and decrease benefits. In what way does any of those three policies stimulate the economy? You need jobs to make the economy keep functioning, right? You need less taxes so that people can actually employ more people. And you also need people to be capable of having benefits just in case they're not employed. They don't have to go out and rob other people and destroy private property.
Well, how does he propose to carry out less jobs as a matter of policy? Do you make a
by
law
cutting
that
government
says
jobs?
Only so many people are allowed to have jobs, and then you have to, what constitutes a job? Is it illegal if your area has passed its quota of productivity? Is productivity outlawed? I mean,
they're talking about amalgamating,
made illegal somehow.
Well, they're actually talking about amalgamating major government departments into super departments, and they're just going to fire all the excess of people.
Well, they're talking about firing government employees, and that would be good for the economy, but not if you raise taxes at the same time.
Exactly. So it's counterintuitive. I mean, by themselves, either one of these things might work, but because they're in concert with each other, it's specifically designed to destroy the economy, or at least that's my opinion. And I think that's what economic hitmen do. They come to your country, destroy your economy, and then once you're all heavily in debt to foreign banks, that's the other part of his economic policy as well. Huge borrowings of debt. So, decrease government employees, borrow heaps of money, increase heaps of taxes, and don't allow anybody any benefits or whatsoever from the government system, even though you just increase their taxes. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
To fly to New Zealand by plane from New York City, it takes 22 hours. So, from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all the time, and 6 hours on a plane is like a lot, and 19 is wrong. And they distract you. They feed you, and then they feed you some more, and then they feed you. Give me a dessert. Give me a dessert. Give me a dessert. Oh, your dessert, you prick. Give me that dessert. Have a Bloody Mary. Yeah, give me a whiskey sour. Yeah, give me whatever you got. Just more liquor. More liquor. More liquor. And then when you're done, there's still 16 hours to go. If you want to know what it's like, you can experience going to New Zealand. It's very simple. Sit in a chair for 19 hours. And take your hands and press your head as hard as you can. And don't stop. Don't stop! 19 hours, just like this. And then at the end of 19 hours, you pull your hands off, and you feel like you're in New Zealand. You certainly won't feel like you're home. They say that New Zealand's beautiful, and I don't know, because by the time I got over the jet lag, I had to go. And it seems to me, if you're going to travel for 19 hours to another country, when you get there, they should have the comments.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live in English on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. You can also join us in the chat room here at TheVinnyEastwoodShow.com. And also, the basic only way that we're really even supporting this broadcast whatsoever is because of contributions from listeners like you. So, if you'd like to pop in and make a donation, we've got a chip-in key there. I'm trying to get my old camera fixed, a big booty one that was donated to me, and I broke it, unfortunately. And it needs to be fixed, about $900 to fix a Sony camera of that magnitude. So if you can give, please give generously. Alternatively, though, if you just want to help with the day-to-day running costs of the show to make sure that we bring on guests like Adam and who did we have yesterday? Max Egan and Lindsay Williams and all those great people that kind of make your life just a little bit more entertaining at the very least, and certainly a heck of a lot more frightening. go and subscribe, $5 a month, and we'll give you commercial-free archives. Now, I was running the numbers on it. If you're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show five times a week, you're spending roughly 10 hours a week listening to it. If you listen to it commercial-free, it cuts out about a half an hour of time that you have to listen to it. So in the aggregate, $5 for 1 month equals about 10 hours of listening time that you have saved yourself. All right? Trust me, it's worth it. You could do an awful lot in 10 hours. That's like a whole working day you've saved yourself for $5. It's worth it. And on top of that, you get commercial-free, again, videos with top activists by webcam. In fact, just today, if you go to the subscribers video page, I have uploaded Jim Fetzer, the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, an hour-long interview with him, and also Stan Deo from StanDeo.com, who wrote The Cosmic Conspiracy, him doing a big presentation on ancient aliens, technology, planetary anomalies, a whole bunch of stuff. And we get to see his computer screen and everything. He's got hard drives that are named Jedi Master and stuff like that. It's a very, very cool video to watch. So Adam Kokesh is my guest today, ladies and gentlemen. And, of course, you could watch and listen to this interview here commercial-free. At the subscribers page too. So, Adam, what we were talking about over the break is just the different economic policies that are being implemented, just destroying the country. And I forgot one: state asset sales. We've got a whole bunch of extremely profitable companies. The New Zealand basically runs the country like an energy conglomerate cartel, not entirely unlike Standard Oil. So the government owns five major electricity companies, and they work as a cartel and have differentials in price that are sometimes fairly negligible. Occasionally, you might find a bargain or whatever, but on the whole, it's a monopoly, you know, just dressed up. So they want to sell those assets now. So instead of getting a dividend check of, I think it was close to nearly $200, if you're a citizen of the country, every year you get a dividend check from those power electricity companies. Not only will you no longer have them, but your electricity prices are also going to go up substantially because private ownership is going to take over. And they've even passed legislation in secret. Well, basically, it's extra clauses later on in the state asset sales legislation. You know how they work, Adam. They kind of like up front, they tell you everything's going to be sweet as and we're going to have this particular restriction on it. But then they write in exemptions for themselves later on for every single thing that matters. And that's precisely what they've done. So, yeah, that's our economic future. Massive increases in debt. No more assets, massive increases in taxes, massive cuts in jobs to the public sector, and, of course, a decrease in benefits for anybody. Does that sound like sound economic policy to you?
No, well, see, this is the thing for me, you know, in terms of my course of realization. Like I said, I realized that there was a disconnect thing, that there was a really painfully obvious disconnect between the will of the people and what government was doing. But what I came to realize after that was that there was a reason for it. You know, as part of the thing of our generation, of libertarians in general, is that we ask why. We always question the purpose of things. And when it comes to government and we ask why, we don't get very good answers very often. And I started asking why. Like, why is there this disconnect? And the only explanation that made any sense to me was that it's in the purpose of government. And the purpose of government is not any of the things in the current paradigm, any of the mythologies about exercising the will of the people or serving the public interest or doing the things that people can't do on their own, right? You've heard that one before. As if government isn't made up of people, it's just, you know, people with guns. So they who feel like they can use them against others and enforce their will by force. No. That's and the only explanation that makes sense is that the purpose of government is to exploit people. It is the only purpose of ever having to force an idea on someone at all. It's just the biggest racket there is. The idea that we need a socially granted monopoly and a central authority on the initiation of force over others, when you really break it down into its core components of what government is, the concept behind it or all of the supposed justifications for it just become ridiculous. And then you can see it for what it is. It is not the will of the people. It is not people trying to do good, although there are some misguided people in government who are there because they're trying to do good. But the fundamental purpose of government is to play off people's fears and insecurities in order to exploit them, to get them to accept the most efficient rip-off in the world. Because when you steal from somebody, when a mugger puts a gun to your head, it's not very efficient. Of course, it's not as effective as, you know, cooperative working together in the free market. But when you look at government as an exploitation racket, as this mass organized theft, then you see how much more efficient, how much more effective it is when you can point one gun and wave it at a room full of people and convince all of them that they need to give you 30% of their income. Or as it is now, really, you know, for the average American, 50% of what you earn during the course of a year goes to government in one form or another. 50%. So why not have a, you know, couple of propagandists and get this scam going and convince people that you need your mugger, and then you can be much more efficient, much more effective when you can do it that way. And the only conclusion I can come to about what government is and the nature of government that actually explains everything that we see.
It does. And what was the... There's that old sort of Sherlock Holmes type problem. If you eliminate the impossible, whatever exists, however improbable, must be the truth. So if you have a look at your government policy, and just recently in the United States, there's been this whole upping of the drones and various other things. The TSA, what is that other one where you can disappear? But NDAA.
Yes.
And so many things that just violate the Constitution. It's like the Constitution's literally having its underwear torn down by a vicious, hairy man and raped. The scariest part of it is everybody sits back and watches it, and they do nothing. You know, the vast majority of them. And the Congress, the Senate, the people who are supposed to be there, your elected representatives, they don't think anything like the people that elected them. They're simply cunning manipulators who convinced everybody that I'm like you, so therefore vote for me. And it was never about you. It was always about me. But I'll not tell you that until I get elected 34 years in a row. They are the most vicious pile of scum, drug dealers, Starburst popping, Prozac prescribed SOBs that have ever really existed. And you wonder how come the country isn't being governed properly. Well, you don't have people of extreme vigilance in the House of Congress anymore, do you, Adam?
Well,
the United States, the Great Republic, is no longer great.
Governed properly. I wonder why people believe that they need to be governed at all, why they wouldn't rather
be free.
But I think I would take, you know, I ran for office myself. And, you know, you're promoting a politician on your with your ads there, playing Ron Paul promo spots. And I think it's more important to take a more nuanced view of politicians, because they have their role in their propagandizing, exploiting class, but it's the ruling class that are the ones that are really running the system and are really benefiting from it. In a way, they're just cogs.
Yeah, I think that's right, because when you look at the elite, you see that they're real psychos. And you have a look at psychos just in general. They seem to have a whole lot of little groveling, swiney, whining little servants, don't they? Who may not be the most evil people or whatever, but they love snuggling up to evil and getting the scraps off of the table like a nice little dog does. Those are the kind of people who I have a problem with. Those who are genuine, on the other hand, and truly want to make a difference, I've got no argument with that whatsoever. Everybody should at least try. We'll be right back after the break with Adam Kokesh, AdamVsTheMan.com. Show broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Who I'd like to speak about just for a moment there. If anybody has a computer or a part for a computer, or is a whiz with computers, or something of that nature, please get in contact with American Freedom Radio. Just go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com. I'm sure you can contact them off the website there. Because there is a desperate need for the replacement of a number of machines at the studio, and it is actually, if you've been listening consistently, there have been a number of technical, quizzical difficulties been happening through my show, at least. I'm not sure about the rest of the hosts straight on through, which have been the fault of the machines. So really do need the support and the help of the listenership at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. So if anybody can help out or would like to offer some suggestions about where to get some cheap equipment or anything of that nature, just go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and send them a message if you can, please, because this is a really good network. And it would be an awful shame if it was suddenly off air because of a technical fault, wouldn't it? Adam Kokesh is my very special guest, and we want to take some callers now. Adam, are you up to take some callers, man?
Absolutely.
Cool. All right. Bring it on.
Well,
yeah, bring it right on. And you'll love the callers that we have calling into this show, too. They're very nice, generally well-spoken, moralistic, and independent people. So the number is 218-339-8525. And we have our first caller on the line already. He's been holding for 6 minutes, Joe in L.A. Joe, welcome to the program. Do you have a question for Adam?
Hey, Vinny, Adam. How are you guys doing today?
Outstanding.
Really nice.
Hey, Adam, just want to say, man, I checked out your speech. It's probably one of the greatest political speeches I've heard in my life. I don't know if you consider it playing it, Vinny. Is it time yet speech? Mm-hmm. That thing gets me so motivated. You know, like I was telling Vinny a couple times I called in, sometimes you get kind of bogged down and wary of the, you know, fighting the cause and protesting and blogging and all that stuff. Sometimes it's good to take a time off and just get back to family and friends. But when I hear that speech, man, it just gets me fired up and gets me ready to go every day and fighting for freedom and stuff like that. It's an admiring, I really admire that speech, bro.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. It's really cool to hear the ripple effects are still occurring from that, from having taken that stand. I assume you're referring to when I say, is it time, the speech at the Revolution March in D.C. in the summer of 2008. That was an incredible experience, and there were so many people there. It really was an incredible event, and I drew my strength from that. I mean, the speech was what it was, because of all the energy from the crowd that day and all the people that encouraged me to say what I had to say. So thanks, man. But, you know, it's feedback like that that keeps me going. And it's you know, activism, it's when you've been doing it as long as I have, I guess you could say, for, I mean, not that I shouldn't say it like that. That sounds like I've been doing it for a really long time. But, you know, since I got out of the Marines, 2007 at least, I guess I've been in it in one form or another, 4.5 years. It's cool to see that there are still those ripple effects, and that things that you did years ago are having good effects on people still. And it's amazing to see that the modern media that we live with makes that possible. So it keeps me going, man. That's how I stay motivated to do the next thing and make the next video and give the next speech or do the next podcast. Absolutely. Hearing from people like you.
Yeah, so many times when you. When you want to stay motivated, it's somebody else that helps keep you motivated. And you were talking about your family and friends there, Joe, and how you listen to that speech and it wants you to keep on fighting on. And I don't know, my perspective is you have to know what you're fighting for. And at the end of the day, it is your families and friends. It's the people next to you. And so don't forget them and spend time with them. And that'll also help you to realize and motivate yourself how important your anchor is.
You're absolutely right. That's when I tell friends, other friends who aren't receptive to the message of liberty and truth and justice, and they ask me why I keep doing this and why I keep talking about this stuff. And I told them it's because of you guys. If it wasn't for my family or friends, I wouldn't be doing what I was doing, you know, and I've been researching this stuff and being active probably for about 17, 18 years now. And there's been a surge in the movements, and it's inspiring. Both of you guys inspire me. And I just had a question for Adam. I don't know if you've heard it in the last few days, I guess the military document that came out speaking about re-education camps and taking activists and putting them to re-education camps. Have you heard about that document?
I have, and it was, of course, preceded by the MIAC report that identified anybody who was a Ron Paul supporter as a potential domestic terrorist. But if you want to know what I think about it, I think it's, you know, there are so many things that the government tries to do, that the government tries to get away with, that the government has plans for, that never come to fruition. And, you know, I see things like that, and I don't discount them as real threats, but I think it's a long way, we're a long ways off from the paradigm being to the point where you can convince the enforcement class, the police and the soldiers, that you need to lock people up for dangerous political beliefs. You know, we're moving that way. But we're still a long ways off. So if they got ahead of themselves and built the actual facilities, you know, I don't think that makes it an immediate threat. So I try to have that, you know, it's really easy. It's really easy when you care about these issues. It's really easy when you get to these topics to get paranoid, to be afraid, you know, and to see all of these threats and think, oh my gosh, you know, I need to buy more food. I need to, you know, be more ready. And I don't mean to discount any of that, because I think those are legitimate efforts too. But at the same time, we need to look at the immediate struggles that are right in front of us, and bringing a greater understanding to the message of liberty is what's going to prevent that from happening. By reaching out like Oath Keepers is doing to members of law enforcement and the military, you know, like for my small part, what I do, I get a lot of listeners who are in the military or left, you know, a lot of veterans as well. And I actually have I'm always surprised to hear that I have a lot of members of the law enforcement community in my audience. But it seems to be a recurring trend that former members of the Praetorian class and current members are attracted to this message because it's coming from me as a former Marine who was willing to pick up a gun and kill people because the government said that they deserve to be killed. And having come out of that, that's the perspective that I've got. And we have to remember that the subculture that is the military and the law enforcement community is not that distinctly different or isolated from the rest of the culture. And yes, the military is the most propagandized population on the planet, and we have that threat. I don't think it is that we are in such a position that, you know, widespread mass roundups of people based on activism or political ideology is really a threat. Now, small scale, yeah, absolutely. Individuals, absolutely. And that's why looking at things like the NDAA and the work like I just did another interview today with Blake Filippi from the Rhode Island Liberty Coalition, who's doing some great work with the 10th Amendment Center on the issue of the NDAA and indefinite detention in the United States, and getting states to actually pass legislation that would make carrying out those provisions illegal in their states. So that's pretty cool. You know, there are practical things you can do to wake people up, and there are practical things you can do to fight back in terms of reducing the actual pain and suffering of statism, of government. But looking at some of the less likely possibilities of what they're going to do, you know, I hope I'm not being overly dismissive, but, you know, when people talk about FEMA camps and things like that, I don't see it as the same immediate threat as what we have around us. And for people that use that as a way to wake people up and talking about that, that's awesome. I totally support that. But I don't support looking at these potential evils of government and being afraid of them and reacting to them when there are real evils of government happening all around us that we can make real progress on.
No, I have to agree with you on that. Actually, I joined the Earth Keepers last year for a specific reason. I used to have a very negative relationship with police, and so I decided to take a step forward and actually reaching out to police locally in my area. I'm in the Harbor area of Los Angeles, and I've been doing that just whenever I get a chance. You know, I see a cop at a subway, and I'll have my pamphlets, and I'll talk to them. And I've been getting pretty good response from a few. A couple of them are kind of, you know, didn't really know what I was talking about. But so that's what I've been trying to do, to at least get the negative feeling out of my heart for police officers like that.
Yeah. That's a good idea too, Ben. For example, the reason why everybody's so freaked out is because they're freaked out about things that don't actually pose an immediate threat. Like, for instance, somebody is going into a beach and they're afraid of getting attacked by a shark, even though they're three times more likely to be struck by lightning. And today, you are far more likely to be killed by peanut butter allergies than by terrorism. Okay? And so what we have to do now, as a people world over, is start focusing on what we can do that's right in front of us and what's actually attacking us right in front of us. I remember I was having a conversation with one guy. He was talking about discovering reptilians and how it's now freaking him out a little bit. And I said to him, look, mate, regardless of whether or not reptilians exist, have you ever met one? Like, no. I mean, maybe, but no. And I was like, okay, well, in that case, the knowledge that there are reptilians doesn't actually affect you here and now. There is no fear because you're probably in all likelihood never going to see one. The fact that they do exist or whatever is freaky enough in and of itself, but you don't need to be afraid because it doesn't actually affect you.
Yeah, I hear you. Whenever I hear stuff like that, I just want to get the word out there that there's actually people who are writing these into policy for military, and there's just people in our government who, you know, would like to have something like that implemented. I got to get back to work here. So I just want to thank you guys for all the great work you guys do.
Excellent. Thanks
Thank
for calling.
Thank you so much for your call.
But, you know, Vinny, you missed the best terrorist statistic comparison. And I don't know if this is true for New Zealand, but in the United States, you are more likely to be killed by a cop than by a terrorist.
And that's so believable, too.
That's crazy. If you think about it for a second, that's kind of obvious. But it's, what's the bigger threat, the government or the terrorists? The government that allegedly protects you from them will kill more people than the terrorists will.
Here's the statistic that I want to see.
But, you know, I'm about the FEMA campus. You said, you know, like you can you put it in the category of reptilians, and I don't want to be that dismissive of it. I don't think it's quite in that category, but you have to be careful because, you know, the FEMA camp issue is on the borderline of it. But I just do put it in that same category, I guess, technically, when it comes down to how much attention should we give it.
Well, yeah, and I just think about it in terms of whether or not it's actually really there, and then whether or not it's actually really going to affect you, whether or not it's really planned to be used on you. And let's say, for instance, FEMA camps. There's a heck of a lot of evidence. It's pretty straightforward. And they're opening up in every single country. I've seen videos coming out of New Zealand, Australia, the United States, UK. There's FEMA camps everywhere. And
you know, we shouldn't be worried about empty prison or empty FEMA camps. We should be worried about full prisons.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that governments like taking this as an excuse to spend more money, you know, doesn't necessarily make it the same kind of threat.
There was even a contract issued in the United States somewhere that a private prison company got a contract from the government, and the government had to guarantee them 90% occupation.
Mm-hmm.
So guaranteed prisonership. I don't get that, man.
Well,
how can you guarantee that people are going to break the law?
By how many inmate nights they had in their jail, they're in their facility. It's so easy to see when you understand the free market how you just simply wouldn't have any of these issues if public safety was provided for by private companies.
Mm-hmm. And the statistic that I really wanted to see, you know, it's terrorism versus peanut butter or terrorism versus choking on a cabbage leaf, is whether or not, who are the two most likely people to kill you? Terrorists, real terrorists, or the FBI that are posing as terrorists?
Yeah, well, if you do the analysis, you know, in the United States, most of the terrorist attacks that you see in the headlines are would-be terrorist attacks that are foiled. Or like in the recent one, the Cleveland Bridge bombing, and it never happened. The Cleveland Bridge bomb plot that was foiled by the brave FBI was almost a case of entrapment by an FBI informant, actually an FBI agent, who was being extorted, basically, because he had just gotten caught writing bad checks. So he's put in a position of economic desperation. What happens next thing you know, he's working for the FBI as a contractor, as a snitch, and now in order to earn his keep and you know, maintain his employment with the FBI, if you can call it that, and his safety from prosecution, because remember, they're holding a gun over his head for his other charges, he has to turn into a snitch and, you know, make life miserable for other people by convincing them to commit crimes. So all this productive capacity is going towards convincing people to commit more crimes.
Now, there's something inherently scary about a government that tries to provoke its own enemy, as opposed to going up to them and saying, hey guys, look, I know that we've been naughty, I know that we've invaded countries all over the place, let's try and make peace of it, and I promise that we'll never invade you again, and we'll never send our own people over there to die needlessly, and we won't come back with depleted uranium poisoning and shorten their lives and spend most of the rest of their days in veterans' hospitals rehabilitating themselves with severed limbs and what have you. We won't do that ever again. We're very, very sorry. Does that sound like something that Barack Obama would say? It'd have to be reality before I believe it. We'll be right back. No one's gonna take me alive. It's time who's come to make things right. You and I must fight for our rights. You and I must fight to survive. We'll be right back. broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com around the world. In the German sense of the word. In fact, we are living in a very Nazi-like world. Have you noticed, Adam, that the Third Reich was actually pretty successful? And it's going strong. You know, it was never truly defeated. It just changed its name and its appearance. And it's as I said, it's still going strong today. Now, the call-in number, ladies and gentlemen, is 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525. Perhaps you'd like to comment on the fasci that are on either side of the Speaker of the House in Congress. Or maybe you'd like to talk about the pentagram layout of Washington, D.C. Or maybe you'd like to talk about the court system and how its varying machinations of scumbaggery are inexorably attempting to incarcerate you for doing absolutely nothing wrong by anybody else. Adam Kokesh is my guest from Adam versus the Man. And I was just thinking over the break, you know, Skeptics Society meetings, Adam, they claim to be skeptical, but they don't technically, in a lot of cases, apply their skepticism equally. For instance, they're nowhere near as skeptical of the official line as they are of a conspiracy theory.
You mean conspiracy skeptics?
Oh, yeah.
Not religious skeptics.
Oh, just people who claim to be skeptics of all time. Because as far as I know, a skeptical mind attempts to challenge its own beliefs consistently so that it does not continue to be mistaken. And there's an old saying that when an honest man discovers he is mistaken, he will either cease to be mistaken or he will cease to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a different kind of skepticism or a sort of false skepticism that people engage in to avoid facing reality. And that's no surprise. You know, it's just part of human nature that we are skeptic of anything that challenges the comfortable status quo. And so a lot of people are more inclined to be skeptical of conspiracies or of libertarianism or of anything that tells them that the government isn't full of nice, wonderful people that are just trying to take care of them.
Mm-hmm. But I find, what if we were doing, say, a presentation on 9/11 or banking or global warming or vaccines or in any of these other type of eclectic bad things that are going on right now to a group of skeptics? I think it would actually be quite an interesting challenge. Because they'll come up with questions and challenges and what have you to your points and evidence. And if you're capable of defending yourself in the main, there might be a few people there who are so skeptical, etc., that they're not actually skeptical at all. They're virtually religious in their belief in the official stories. The other people there who are genuinely skeptical would suddenly realize the obviousness of the truth.
Well, you know, statism is really a religion. Statism is not a moral philosophy. It's a religion that justifies immorality. The very nature of government itself, of turning to government to solve social problems, of forcing your will on someone else instead of using persuasion to get them to go along or do what you want to do. It is a religious belief that you can magically institutionalize a government and have it do these things that are immoral for and counterproductive for individuals, but are somehow moral and righteous in government. I mean, if anything qualified as a religion, statism certainly does.
Is it because people are removed from the solution and the consequences of supporting government?
Removed from the they're certainly removed from the consequences. That's the whole government scam, but it's starting to wear thin now as the dollar system collapses and people are starting to see through it. Although, you know, when the dollar collapses, I'm anxious for that moment to come, but at the same time, I'm fearful that we won't have woken up enough people to the reality of government and of a forced fiat currency, and that there will be a showdown between people that want to go to a global fiat currency that say we need government to control something as important as the medium of exchange, and people that want free market money that want open competition. And there might be enough people
that at least understand that using the force of government to stifle competition, like we saw with, you know, Wernher von Otthaus, the Liberty Dollar incident, people getting arrested for creating alternate commodity-backed currencies here in the United States, and you know, violating the legal tender laws. But already we have the we have Bitcoin. We at least have a competing fiat currency that the government has to deal with, where there isn't an inflation system that goes to the government. And it's almost cool that they did an end run around the law by coming up with this concept of Bitcoin. And I think in a lot of ways that's how government's going to be defeated, not by direct confrontation, but by just rendering it obsolete by finding ways around it.
I think it's like scamming them at their own scam.
Hmm.
Ultimately, I think that's all you can do when you're dealing with a con man, is you just have to con them better than they're conning you, so that they end up with nothing and you end up with your freedom.
Oh, I hope it works that way.
And your wealth intact. Now, when we talk about leaving your wealth intact and all of that kind of stuff, ideas. I think ideas are a great source of wealth, whether or not you're coming up with a product or you're actually willing to apply them and start a company. And a lot of times we self-censor a little bit, and there's certain ideas and concepts that when we're on radio or even with certain people, family or friends or whatever, you don't want to talk about it to say, because you think it might be just a little bit offensive for them. And for some reason or another, didn't come up in the conversation, or you held your tongue for one reason or another, these things just don't wind up getting said very often, because we don't feel that we have the freedom to express them. It's as if we're our own enforcers of political correctness. So, Adam, I'd like to invite you, if you have anything of that nature that's somewhat risque, that you normally don't talk about, this is basically the show where you can. And I'd like
what? I normally talk about everything. I mean, I normally talk about the most difficult stuff there is. This is, I mean, if you want to start getting into religion, here we'll guarantee we can either alienate or wake up all the religious people in your audience right now. Because it's funny that when I started talking about atheism, I got viciously attacked by Christians on my Facebook page, on Twitter, and on YouTube. But the great intellectual pillars of our movement, Ayn Rand and Murray Rothbard, were both atheists. And it's not a coincidence. It's the logical conclusion of the school of objectivism that Ayn Rand was a champion of, that she identified. I don't think she invented it, but the idea of rational observation and deductive reasoning being the only way to conclude any specific truths about the world that we live in, you know, to see that people will say, well, we're going to take this as fact because it was in a book or because it was, the idea that our parents gave us. We're not going to question it. But from the same sense that I can say I think, therefore I am, and apply the logical, methodological way of thinking about things that lead me to be a voluntarist, that lead me to be a libertarian, I have to come to the same conclusion when it comes to religion, that no authority is legitimate. And that even, you know, what we call faith, when people presume faith to be fact, something that they consider that they know there is no evidence for, no conclusive reasoning that leads someone to believe that any particular God is real, that's the first step. But then the next step is being really truly objective about the idea of whether or not there is a God. And I for a long time was agnostic, and I think it was kind of a cowardly position to just say, oh, I don't know, and say I believe in human humility, which is true. But my belief in human humility has to be, tempered in order to make any kind of progress with a belief in humanity itself, with a faith. And in a way, objectivism is also a faith. Faith in humanity, faith in reason, faith in humans' abilities to apply deductive reasoning and logic to problems around us in the universe. And when you do, the very concept of a being both all-knowing and all-powerful is inherently contradictory. The very concept of God, as proposed by every major religion or every Judeo-Christian or the Muslim faith of God being both all-knowing and all-powerful, is an obvious logical contradiction, because if you are all-knowing, then you know, and you can tell this from physics, but you don't need physics to understand that if you are all-knowing, you can predict the future. You know exactly what will happen. And if you know exactly what will happen, you are therefore powerless to change it. If such is your understanding of the universe, then you can't have that power. So the very concept, but every single concept that the human mind has ever devised for a supernatural being has simply been wishful thinking, filling in an unknown, saying, I don't know where the universe came from, so I'm going to fill this unknown with my own wishful thinking of what God could be, of what God might be, and therefore it's this. And it's just that because I say it's that, not because of any proof or any reason. And every single concept that the human mind has ever devised for anything supernatural can be proven by deductive reasoning to not be possible. So that's the cold, hard reality. But you know what? It's really liberating. It is truly liberating when you understand that all you have been doing, if you're a believer of some kind of supernatural flying spaghetti monster or some kind of God, that all you have been doing is filling in for rationality with wishful thinking because of your own insecurity. Very empowering, and it gives people the ability to take charge of their lives, take responsibility for their lives, instead of sort of passing that off to an external authority, be it government or a God. It's still an escape from the cold, hard, and beautiful and liberating and empowering reality that life has the meaning that we give it, that we can choose to be happy and live by whatever values we choose for ourselves, and that doesn't have to be imposed by any wishful thinking or by any external authority. And it makes those ethereal unknowns of the universe that much more, and ourselves and our own nature, that much more wondrous and amazing to live with than to simply pass off superstition as a substitute for rational thinking.
That's the difference between wishful thinking and willful action. If you act instead of just thinking about it positively, that thing that you wanted to get done, magically enough, winds up getting done. It's pretty strange. Putting your mind to it doesn't work. Putting your heart into it, on the other hand, truly does. And if that's the divine spirit in your heart that tells you what you should be doing, keeps you motivated regardless, then who is anybody else to question your own judgment? And it's a personal belief thing for everybody, isn't it, Adam? I mean, as an atheist, do you think that other people can choose to believe what they want to believe, even if you don't agree with them?
Well, of course, everybody has that choice. But, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm an atheist. And while the label might fit, I really do. And I don't object to labels in general. I'm not an atheist in that my belief or my presumption or my religion is that there is no God. I'm a philosopher. I'm an objectivist. In the Randian tradition, I believe in the capacity of human reasoning and logic, and I believe in not relying on wishful thinking or superstition to answer unknowns that we find before us. So that's my belief. I'm not an atheist. I'm a philosopher, and philosophy tells me that there is no God. At least there is no God as any human being has ever conceived or proposed. So it's liberating. Philosophy, having that understanding of the world, that ability to apply the human mind to problems with rational, logical analysis as opposed to that wishful thinking is empowering and liberating. So people have the right to choose to be wrong, to say that the meaning of life comes from God or Jesus or from Mohammed or from some ancient text. And that's their right, but it's still wrong. You know, I like we talked about being obese. You have a right to eat yourself into obesity. That's fine. You have a right to indulge in whatever delusional thinking leads you to believe that that is a good decision or a way of looking at the world. And you have a right to decide in your own mind that there is a God or 10 gods or 1,000 gods or 0 gods. And if you don't impose that on anybody else, that's fine. But obviously, the reason that you bother to make that choice is because there's some relevance for it. So most people understand that spirituality now has been a hindrance to mankind. Most people are not Bible literalists. Most people are not religious in America today, at least. There's certainly a streak of Christianity. but and a lot of people identify with religion because religion provides a very quick fix to certain problems like low self-esteem. Well, you get a sense of identity out of religion that provides a preventative measure for that. You know, for some people, you get a sense of community when you're surrounded by people that share the same delusions as you. But that's not, you know, that doesn't make it right. That doesn't make it, you know, a superior way of living your life, or, you know, in a sense we can say objectively the correct way of living your life, free of delusions. And people have the right to handicap themselves, and, you know, we don't have a right to try to maximize someone else's correctness by force because we know we're so right. But
Indeed. Well, we're right back after the break with Adam Kotkesh. 218-339-8525 is the number to call.
The world we knew is gone. The conditions which framed and taught us our status have gone.
Boogie Nets on. The Schwarzenegger sense of the word. My very special guest, Adam Kokesh. Hey, Adam, what if I share with you what my concept of God is? I think it's different from everybody else's. My concept is that God is kind of like a latent organism, a macro organism, if you will. When you look inside a human body, you find out that one human body, that one organism, is made up of, say, trillions of cells. You look inside each of those cells, and under this magnifying microscopes and what have you, you find out that those cells are made up of all these other little cells and organisms. You look inside those, and they're all made up of all these other ones. And as far as we know, it's infinite down the scale. Organisms building up organisms building up organisms. And my postulation is that it goes infinitely up the scale as well. That there's an organism that you and I and everybody else is a part of. Perhaps, I don't know, maybe it's the Earth organism, and it has its own consciousness, its own feelings, and whatever. And it's part, and we're all part of it, and it's part of all of us. And possibly part of the latent energies, perhaps our, perhaps unawakened psychic thoughts or feelings or emotions of the collective organisms on this planet make up some form of consciousness that manages to dictate events. But that organism in itself is only one part of a much larger organism, perhaps called the galaxy or something up the scale from that, and so on and so forth, infinitely up, infinitely down. And we're simply experiencing this little part of our own little lives called experience. And it's very subjective. And we get to have a heck of a lot of fun. And the God organism doesn't technically have any direct control over us, but it may or may not be there. I don't know.
Well, as long as you recognize that it might not, that's the important thing. And have that humility in your conclusion, at least. But let me ask you, since you seem to have a well-thought-out concept of what God is, if someone proved to you that God that you suggest was impossible, how would you feel?
I'd feel like, okay, sweet as. I was wrong, and now I'm not. Now I know it doesn't exist.
Well, you see how most people, if you ask most people who are religious, you know, how would it make you feel if someone proved that Jesus Christ, as an historical figure, is not possible? And they would say, well,
I would feel lost. I wouldn't know what to do. I wouldn't know how to live. I wouldn't have any sense of morality. And to recognize that there is that psychological desire, that need, that can be better addressed by therapy and examining one's own issues than by turning to religion is far superior than all the people who are turning to, you know, Bible literalism as their substitute for addressing, you know, very real important personal issues. And it comes out of a certain insecurity. So I think, again, in the same way that, you know, people will freak out if you try to, you know, people who believe in Christ as an historical figure who is the Son of God, when presented with the actual evidence or physics that makes that not possible, they would rather violently resist that reality than address their own insecurity. And this is a part of the human condition that comes from, you know, how we evolved in our own, what we faced in our environment that made it necessary for us to survive. That if it was something that challenged that which allowed us to get on a daily basis, and it was a dangerous idea, we were more likely to survive sometimes if we were violent, if we killed the messenger, so to speak, rather than face the truth. And now we're at a point where that's not the case, where rationality has been demonstrated to always be superior, although there are some times when, you know, a flight or flight, knee-jerk reaction might save your life, but never when it contradicts rational analysis that's possible. And so a lot of people end up living emotionally unhealthy lives because they're able to do so because the mythology that religion puts forth for them prevents them from having to examine their real insecurities. Now, that's not everybody who's religious, but that's definitely one of the driving factors behind religion. And you see, it's the exact same thing with statism. When you tell people, hey, government is immoral, when they depend on government, it makes them uncomfortable. You know, and to a certain extent it should, but that discomfort is where progress is made, by addressing it, not by hiding from it. And in the same sense, I think as we kill the religion of statism, people will be able to grow past all of the insecurities that lead them to conclude these ridiculous fantasies called religion that dictate how they should live their lives and give meaning to their lives in a way that disempowers them from creating that meaning for themselves.
Yeah, I don't think that thou shalt violently oppose reality was one of the Ten Commandments. but it does raise an interesting point, though, that delusions...
Oh, man, if you want to get into the specific contradictions of Christianity like that, we'll be here all night.
Well, I just wanted to make this point, is that delusions can actually make you think that you've got power. And occasionally, just the thought that you have power because of that delusion can actually save your life.
It's true.
In a uniform, for instance.
If you are in a state where rationality escapes you, where you are incapable of making the right decision from a rational conclusion, yes, it is possible that your shortcoming may be compensated for by a knee-jerk reaction. So it's true, and that explains it. That explains why this element of human nature is a part of our DNA.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's both the best and the worst in us, because we can, for example, somebody can keep trying to do the same thing in the belief that they will eventually succeed, but continuously fail and fail and fail, whereas somebody can keep trying to succeed and eventually do so. How do you differentiate between what's perseverance and what's completely denying reality in and of itself?
Mm. How do I? Well, yes, I think that's always a case-by-case basis, but there's obviously, you know, there's a difference between people that are persistent because they have a delusion and they're persistent, say, in donating to the church every week. They put $20 in the collection plate versus someone who is persistent and understands that the reason they are persistent is to advance humanity through some scientific discovery or some innovation or some work of creativity and productivity, rather than, it's something that they have chosen as a meaning rather than from an external source.
And that would also depend on whether or not that church collection plate winds up in the hands of the community that that church services, you know, with food, meals, community activities, etc. There's a lot of good church programs out there, or whether or not it winds up in the pockets of the Vatican, which own a lot of the major banks, including Westpac Bank, which does all the banking for New Zealand and its government. So there's a lot of interesting ins and outs here, because I'm starting to think that there's a split between those who are truly believers in a genuine faith kind of way versus those who are trying to manipulate people into believing it faithfully so that they can fleece them and use that flock that they're fleecing to perpetrate all of this division and anger and aggression all over the world that will make people hate people who are religious, you know, just in general. Mm. And so all of a sudden, a good portion of where a lot of moral principle came from in the early settlements of the United States grew out of principally, as far as my research has led me to believe, of parents reading the Bible to their children and having those moral doctrines installed. And that was what created a relatively civil and very efficient, morally trading, almost virtually no government, virtually no police society, whose economy grew exponentially. So,
right, no, in a way, it's important to recognize that in compared to primitive societies that weren't even able to ask the question, is there a God or not, the idea of having a uniting mythology, whether or not it was true, was an advancement in evolution. Being able to say, having a force that brought people together as a community, that encouraged good productive behavior, was a competitive advantage between societies. And so for a certain period of time, those that were religious in that way had enjoyed that advantage. But now it's simply not true, and we're able to see past the delusions and really ask those questions and embrace the unknown. And that's and in doing so, be much more capable of all those things that we agree, you know, are good for humanity, that we should all be prosperous and able to take care of our children and send them to good schools and create a better world for them rather than, you know, than the age of the past. But, you know, we're in the same way that society is evolving past statism, we are also evolving past religion.
You know what? I think that there is an interesting point in there, is that eventually concepts that get old and forgotten about, when they return, people think they're revolutionary. And some concepts that get old and out of practice, when they get revamped, people think they're extraordinary. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Adam Kokesh was my guest. Thank you, Adam. AdamVersusTheMan.com.